The Oxford Dictionary gives a definition for a gyroscope in these words. It is a device consisting of a wheel or disc mounted so that it can spin rapidly around an axis that is itself free to alter in direction. The orientation of the axis is not affected by the tilting of the mounting, so gyroscopes can be used to provide stability or maintain a reference direction in navigation systems, automatic pilots, and stabilizers. Toy gyroscopes are wound with a pull string, like a spinning top. Poet Jenny Hill gives us an experience of herself as a gyroscope in a few stanzas she calls Self-Portrait as a Gyroscope for Dan. First the thread of birth and desire, and the slow winding toward reason at a series of smooth-topped desks, a lust to move, waiting a long time for poise, for someone to love me enough to help with balance. Then lured by the line that leads to the center, pulls and lets me go. My dance dressed up as hunger, spinning like a moon in a dream of gold and red flowers, a flame in the center of the one word that is your axis. Finally, the freedom to defy gravity, at least for a little while. Then the tilt, the lilt toward forever. Let me be your vision of circles, possessive and faithful, the heart of your wheel, a singing bowl that fills all negative space with a resonant tilt-to-whirl razzmatazz jazz. The poem Self-Portrait as a Gyroscope for Dan by Jenny Hill. We'll soon learn that a gyroscope is one of Jenny Hill's favorite toys. Another favorite toy is the hula hoop. In fact, Jenny is now a circus-style multi-hoop performer and instructor. In an earlier conversation, we asked Jenny, knowing she's a poet too, whether she sees all these circles in some sense as a metaphor.
When you see video of me hooping, I am usually trapped inside five or six, or, you know, if I'm doing a stack, a whole stack of 20, I'm inside this little universe, you know, my own little universe. But it's, you know, it's, as a kid, I never felt that free, that finding movement, finding a voice. My body has a voice, you know, and it took a hula hoop, a silly plastic circle, for me to be able to open up like that.
Al Monelli, a filmmaker from northeastern Pennsylvania, who now lives and works in Lancaster, as does Jenny, was drawn into Jenny's orbit, and he's gone on to work with her to produce a short documentary titled One Hoops, centering on Jenny and her creative life. Jenny Hill and Al Monelli returned to northeastern Pennsylvania to talk with us about making the film and about the creative process. We continue our conversation from yesterday about what it was like for an artist like Jenny to be shadowed by another creative artist in this way.
It was fun to watch what he keyed in on. And just like when I watch his films, even the ones that he does for work, for FNM, he just has a really great eye for composition and for detail. So many of the wedding videos, I think I really have stalked your films.
That's fine. My mom does too. So.
Okay, good. You know, there's a very brief moment in one of them where he focuses on an umbrella. It's one of those clear umbrellas that were so popular in the 1970s. I think I had one as a kid. And someone twirling that umbrella, or a little girl kind of dancing on her
like little white shoes that like a girl would, like a flower girl would wear for a wedding, and she was standing on the heels.
Yeah, like
just
rocking.
The heels, so her toes were pointed up and she was kind of swaying back and forth. Yeah.
But that kind of attention to detail is impressive to me. I think that shows somebody that's really watching the world, really paying attention. That's a poet's eye. And I know I've said that a bunch of times, like, Al is a visual poet. He's a visual poet. And I mean it.
Is there a temptation when you have such a wonderful eye and you have such visual excitement with spinning hoops and a torso and a body and
all of these things to overdo the coolness of those images? Did you have to restrain yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I feel like I had to restrain a lot of things. I have access to a drone, so I can get amazing aerial shots, like spectacular looking vistas. There are only two in the entire movie, and one comes at the end when she moves out of her apartment, spoiler alert, and, you know, we see this sort of farmland now. And she moved not to a farm, but out into more of a country location. And, you know, we see the cross in the road, so I thought that was my little... It might be a little too symbolic, but, that was intended. And the other one is in the opening montage, and it only lasts for a second, if that. So, you know, the whole thing, it was about... When I realized what I wanted to make... I want everything to obviously look good. You know, I try to shoot everything to look nice. But, you know, when she tells the story about Helen about the dollhouse, I keep it on her face most of the time, which isn't very cinematic. And a lot of documentary filmmakers now are starting... This theory is prevailing that I don't really agree with or like, and it's that talking heads in interviews are not cinematic and do not belong in movies, even documentaries. And I don't agree with that. I don't agree with it because had I gone down that path of thinking, we wouldn't have that moment where we see her. And it's not the fact that she's crying. It's the fact that we can experience the shift in her face. We could see it. If you couldn't see it, you don't connect with it as much. So by seeing it, like I still watch... You know, I'll watch the film for some reason, or I'll have to make sure something is working or whatever. And I get to that part. I feel something inside every time. Even though I know it's coming, I still have something inside just kicks. And it's because we could see it. And we can connect with it. And we can look into her eyes and connect with it. Now, again, if I had just done voiceover, we did record an interview with no camera. I just put a mic on her and recorded to a Zoom recorder, and we sat in her closet, actually, on the floor, because in her apartment, the traffic was pretty noisy because she lived in the city. So we sat in a closet and recorded for like an hour and a half. You know, I just asked you everything. And the funny thing is, like, two sentences for that entire hour and a half ended up in the film. But it took that hour and a half to not only get those two sentences, but to also realize I needed to have a sit-down interview with her. I needed the camera to be on her. And again, just pointing the camera at someone doing a hula hoop is interesting. It's engaging. It's wow, it's excitement, it's fast, it's motion. But a lot of documentaries today that I see online, it's a lot of just acrobatics. It's a lot of slow motion when you don't need slow motion, or, you know, shallow depth of field when you don't need shallow depth of field. And I mean, this film has both of those things, but I tried to limit them. And, you know, I wanted the climax of the film to be that performance in Penn Square. And I didn't want to use any, you know, I had recorded, she had given several, like, thoughts about that. I remember asking you afterwards, I don't know if you remember, I was like, how do you think it went? You know, and you were like, I think it went well. And I remember you said, I think we made a lot of people happy. And I had that line in the edit for a long time. And then I realized I don't need that line because we see you making people happy, especially the homeless man at the very climax. That, to me, is the climax. So we see it, and again, it wasn't the best shot in the world. If I was given the opportunity to compose the shot and not have to rush over to try to capture that moment, it would have been a different looking shot. It would have been perfect. Everything would have been in frame. But the fact that you see me like hurrying over and trying to get the camera, and we just barely see your hand coming off of his chest, which is one of my favorite moments in the entire film. I could have taken that. I could have been like, oh, this is shaky. We can barely see what's going on. But it to me, it worked. So it fit the story, and it worked, and that is the climax.
Does it feel that way to you, too?
Yeah, definitely. That whole... The whole Penn Square experience, I really... We had so many conversations about social media and phones in particular, and I remember having conversations about just how you know, how audiences are now perceiving or experiencing theater, concerts, art, most of them from behind a screen. And, you know, is that good? Is that bad? Well, it is, right? And it's going to continue. It's going to persist. And at some point he asked, you know, does that bother you when you're in a, you know, when you're performing and you have people videoing you rather than being in the moment, you know, really paying attention? And I said, well, I would prefer, it's live theater. I would prefer if they would be present. But there is an element of, it makes me feel like, well, they feel that this is something preserving or saving or sharing with someone else that isn't there. So there's that element as well. So I really like what Al did with showing how the adults are experiencing the performance, the pop-up circus, and how the children are experiencing it. That I really enjoyed.
I've had two people tell me that that moment teared them up. It made them cry. And it's interesting because I knew I wanted to use that to say something about technology. And like I said earlier, the ultimate goal of what I do is I like that sort of childlike nostalgia in things. I love movies that have it, TV shows, whatever. And I felt like this was the perfect way to show that. And it really hits home a message. And one of my friends saw it and he told me he was watching it. And he's like, I thought it was cool when you were showing the cell phones. And I thought, oh, good for Jenny. Like, people are filming it. That's great for her. And then he goes, but then you showed the kids. And then I realized what you were doing. And he got very emotional about it. And so I was happy about that. Because that, to me, the way I structured the film was, that was supposed to be the climax. And it's kind of funny to think about it, but a big influence on me and on this film is The Sixth Sense. I don't know if you've ever seen The Sixth Sense. It's a great movie. And I wish we could see the look on Jenny's face, and your face. It's great. That movie was written, the climax of that film, the arc of that film, leads to the scene with the little boy and his mom in the car at the end. This emotional scene where he tells his mom that he can actually see ghosts and that he proves it to her by telling her, reciting to her things that she said to her mother's grave that only he would know because the grandmother told him. So the whole movie was about communication and how this little boy didn't really communicate well with his mom. So this is the emotional climax of the movie. And the director, M. Night Shyamalan, said he had to nail that scene and make the audience feel like, okay, the movie is done. Like, we have reached what the goal was, to get this little kid happy and connecting with his mom, because their relationship was very, you know, hard. And he goes, and that's why the twist ending in The Sixth Sense works so well, because people are emotionally done. So they think the movie is over. So they get this coda, this extra scene that they don't see coming, and it just blindsides them. And with this movie, that's what I tried to do with the end, when all of a sudden we have this emotional climax. Okay, Jenny has succeeded in what she wants to do. She made people happy. Happy ending. And then it's like, boom. Then very next scene is her having to leave and move out of her apartment in Lancaster City, which to me was the... When you told me you were moving, I remember I was so like, oh man, like, is this going to screw up the movie? Like, is Jenny like not going to even want to do it anymore? Is she going to be upset? But, a series of films about Lancaster that take place in Lancaster where she's moving out of the city, like, I was like, this is a perfect ending. So I knew I wanted it to kind of be like a twist almost. So in a way, The Sixth Sense has severely inspired this film.
We're radio, so we are not visual, but your hair is beautiful and long right now, and it's covering your necklace.
This necklace is probably upside down. It likes to flip. It says happy, and it's probably from the early 1970s. It belonged to my sister, Kristen. She's my older sister, my big sister. And I always used to sneak into her room and borrow, air quotes, her clothing, her stuffed animals. Everything that she had was so much better than everything I had, which really wasn't true, but because she was older, it was. And I looked up to her, and I still do. But this necklace belonged to her. And I always used to go into her room and borrow her jewelry, put it on, and then I wouldn't be able to get it off. So I'd just grab it and tear it off. Which she didn't appreciate. But yeah, this necklace was one of hers. And she is currently living in Japan. And they moved from Tokyo recently to about 2.5 hours, I believe, north of Tokyo. And now she's in the countryside, a wooded area, actually. So we both made moves out from the city and into the countryside. And when she made that move, she said, I have some things that I want to get rid of. You know, I'm not planning on keeping them. Do you want me to send them to you and Helen? And I said, oh, absolutely. And this necklace was among the things. So I wear it often.
And you used it, Al.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny. I didn't make this connection, but other people did. And I think you even did in the beginning when it's showing you at 16 going, you know, I hate this song. And then you go, I hate cameras. And the very next shot, you're saying, I love playing pretend, creating characters. Mm-hmm. So it's going from a hate to love. And I show the happy necklace up close. And people have made that connection that I didn't even intend. And I can't take credit for it, but it's that sort of maturation. It turns on a dime all of a sudden. You know, it jumps to a different, almost Jenny in a way. So I felt like the necklace was a perfect way to introduce you, in a sense.
Watching the footage of myself when I was 16, 17 years old, I remember making those videos with my sister. My dad had borrowed a video camera from somebody at work, and Kristen and I just had a great time over the holidays indulging ourselves in videoing and asking questions and, you know, whatever. But watching that beginning of the film and seeing myself at 16, 17, and some of the facial expressions I make, the way I'm looking, like, from underneath my eyelashes, like, there's just this teenage look of contempt for the world that I don't think I can do anymore. I wish I could. I mean, I was actually practicing it in the mirror. I can't do it. I think that's a look that you have at a certain point in your life, and then it goes away.
But I think it also shows your evolution as a person in a way. That person that we see at 16, if I was only to see that footage, and you'd be like, what do you think that girl is going to be like when she's older? I wouldn't say anything that you are now. So I think it's really cool to see that just because if you're young and you're kind of shy and don't like being in front of cameras or may not know what you like to do, that doesn't mean you're going to always be like that. You know, it's just kind of showing that you weren't this way when you were young. You weren't like this sort of whimsical. Well, you may have been. I'm sure it existed in you. But when the camera was pointed at you, when you were in the spotlight, you know, you kind of weren't ready for it looked like.
I wasn't.
But when it was off, I bet you were. Like you said, you know, when you were by yourself in your room, I bet then it came out.
Oh, yeah. It did. One of the things that I wanted to mention was that footage from the 80s footage. I knew I had those VHS tapes, and they were in the basement in our storage unit, and I found them. Anyway, Al took them, and he emailed and said, here's a file for you to watch. You know, I got what I could. I couldn't get it all. You know, years go by, and there's a degradation to the tape. And, well, I click on play, and I see myself at 17. Oh, cringeworthy, right? So I fast forward. You know, I take that little bar, and I move it forward. What else is on here? I forget. I think it was Christmas time, and I see my father. And I burst into tears because to see someone you love so much who has passed away moving again, you know, I have still photos of him. And of course, I have his voice in my head and great memories. But to see him there actually moving and mugging for the camera, and then to see my mother young, you know, like strong, close to my age at that point. Really, really powerful and such a gift. Like, that was such a big gift that came from this film for me.
You just talked about seeing your dad again, your dad moving. And the two poles, motion and stillness, seem to play a part in your art.
I also have this lifelong obsession with gyroscopes. That's my toy of choice outside of the hula hoop. And this is kind of funny. I never really thought of this. But yeah, the gyroscope has that still point. And then the inside is the word, the wheel on the inside is just whirling around. And it's such a magical toy because once it starts to lose its momentum, it wobbles, but it wobbles in this very dance-like way. And then eventually, you know, falls on the desk. I had a gyroscope that I wrote a poem about. And as a child, I had this gyroscope and I had it on my desk and I was playing with it after we were finished with our achievement tests, if anybody remembers taking achievement tests. And so I was playing with this and my mother came to pick me up from school and I didn't know why. And it was because my grandfather had died. And so I have this like really strong attachment to the way a gyroscope moves and its meaning and the whirls of it and how it ends. It's a life in one toy.
Talking about movement and stillness in the film, there are some beautiful pictures of profiles, just where a little wisp of hair is blowing. And that's a lovely thing, too. They're quiet moments, and you're not telling us anything. We're just getting to see or experience the presence and the way you are alive to the world. And I think those moments do that as well.
My favorite shot in the whole movie, my favorite shot is her backstage at the elementary school balancing the feather on her hand. My absolute favorite shot and moment in the entire movie is that. And it's because she started doing that. I wasn't filming when she started doing that. The camera was down. We were just standing there waiting. And she all of a sudden just started balancing a feather. And I'm like, that's kind of interesting. Let me pull the camera out. And your back was to me. So that's why I was like, I don't even know if she knows I'm filming yet. And then it's funny, we see you kind of trying to balance this feather and there's no sound. You can faintly hear children in gym class in the background. But I think it encapsulates you in one image. And I just love how quiet it is. And it shows your determination to get something right and to practice and to be prepared, because that's a big part of it. And you know, you mentioned all the hours that you put in, and we see it right there. Just, you know, 15 minutes before a show, you could be sitting there tweeting or whatever, but you're trying to get that feather, you know. So,
and isn't that a metaphor for life, trying to get that feather to balance?
I asked you about learning about the creative process, but if you hadn't had this experience, what kinds of things might you say have been a gift from having taken part in this experience?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is getting to know Jenny and developing that friendship there. But, and I think that's obvious. Beyond that, you know, I tried different things with this. And there were times when I remember saying to some people before it was completely done, when I knew it was like done, but not officially done, when I had to do a few more tweaks, I remember thinking, I don't know if people are going to like this. Like, I don't know if this is going to be easily digestible for the average person. But I didn't care because I loved it. And I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that you love something that you create, because with this, I was plucking out the things of Jenny that I liked because, you know, I can identify with them. Or not that I have to identify with them, but that I feel like they're almost parts of me. The dedication of time and hours to your craft and all that stuff. And I made something that was longer, 15 minutes. In this day and age, we're always told, make your videos a minute, 2 minutes long. You know, no one's going to sit there and watch. So, here's a 15-minute film where you're just following someone. And, you know, I tried spots where there's no dialogue, like you pointed out. I tried spots where it was just music, which is the climax. I tried spots where it was just all talking, all Jenny's face telling a story. So I definitely experimented with a few different things and found new ways of doing things that I like. And I realized that I do want to shoot the interview on camera and not just leave it to two people talking in a closet.
Jenny?
Well, definitely the friendship. You know, any experience where you get to connect with somebody and get to know them, this has been really wonderful. I feel like in many ways, and this is going to probably come off wrong, but It's very humbling to be followed by someone who is making art, and you are. And there were places where, even in our conversation today, I'm being discussed, and I am sitting here, and it makes me blush. And you know, it's nice to hear these things, but it also, I'm shifting in my seat. My body language is showing it. You have no idea. Now I'm sitting on my hands. I mean, it does make you feel a little uncomfortable, but also warm and loved. And in some ways, while you were working on this, I felt like I was being perpetually eulogized. I have this really dark place where, you know, I was worried that when the movie was done, I'd be done. That was it. You know, this was going to be played at my funeral, and that's it. That's Jenny Hill. Here we go. she's done. And it was also, like I said before, watching somebody else, another artist, make their art was a gift. To be reminded of the fact that, you know, you do need to sit in a closet for several hours sometimes getting audio that you're going to use maybe a sentence worth of. And there so much work goes into the behind the scenes, you know, the things that you don't see. And that's for every art form. That's for writing a play. That's for writing a poem. That's for making a painting, you know. Creating a book by hand, you know, there's so much that goes into that, and it's a great reminder for now, because in a world where I think we're so used to, it's short attention span theater, like you said, you know, make your movies a minute, 2 minutes long maximum, because that's all the attention people have. When you're creating, that's also kind of in the back of your mind that, well, nobody's really going to want to see more than 2 minutes of this. So should I put more than 2 minutes worth of effort into it? Should I put more than 4 minutes worth of effort into it? Yes, you should, you know. So watching your process reminded me of that and my own creations of things, acts and writing and all of that, is to have that focus and to spend the time.
How can we see this film now?
Well, it's online for free on Vimeo or on my website, MinelliFilms.com. Honestly, if you just go to Google and type in One Hoops short documentary, it'll come up. You'll see a video with a young woman with bright red hair and a sort of pink. What would you call that?
That's a clown collar.
Yeah. A clown collar, a pink clown collar and her glasses.
Filmmaker Al Minelli describing one of the oh-so-delightful images from the short documentary film One Hoops, which he produced about Jenny Hill and her creative life. Al Minelli is a filmmaker originally from northeastern Pennsylvania who works at Franklin and Marshall College. He has a degree in film from Long Island University, and One Hoops is the final chapter of his Lancaster trilogy, centering on creative individuals from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You can find him on the web, MonelliFilms.com, M-O-N-E-L-L-I, MonelliFilms.com. Jenny Hill is a poet, playwright, and performing artist. For over 15 years, she has worked with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, sharing creative writing and movement residencies in schools, senior centers, and with community organizations. She is the author of 7 books of poetry and 2 books of prose, as well as an editor and designer at Paper Kite Press. For more information on the web, actsofgenius.com, actsofgenius.com, and that's J-E-N-N-I-U-S, J-E-N-N-I-U-S, actsofgenius.com. And again, to view the film One Hoops, you can find it online at no charge, MonelliFilms.com, 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 One Hoops.